for a short time to make sure that we brought that the council was fully informed before it was asked to make a decision and support the omnibus SBRM amendment. And the reason for this is because the consequences of implementing this amendment, which is in response to a court order, a lawsuit, and a settlement, are going to be profound, because they're going to constrain our collective ability with regards to where and when and how we place observers. They're going to constrain us to the extent that we must first meet the requirements, the sampling requirements, the observer coverage requirements that are defined within the SBRM amendment, before we can use resources from most of the budget lines that support the observer program for other kinds of observer and at-sea monitoring activities. Wendy will provide you with a lot of details about how the program works so that you can better understand where the money comes from, what kind of quantities of money we're talking about, and how that money is used. So it's really an attempt that we're making to try and clarify to the extent possible the economics and the logistics of running an observer program and some of the capacity constraints that we have, because I think it's very important for the council to understand those. And I think having that as a prelude to the council's discussion or briefing and discussion about SBRM is very important, because these two things are so tightly linked together. SBRM is important because the fundamental responsibility of observers and of the observer program is really to collect the base data that's necessary to properly account for bycatch and discard in the regional fisheries. And even if we're able to meet the SBRM threshold, the minimum coverage requirements that are defined in SBRM, we will still only provide estimates of those quantities with a high degree of uncertainty. The CV targets are around 30%. And so from a science point of view, I would argue that it is actually very important that we define and maintain the focus on the scientific sampling to provide that data. And that's data that isn't just of abstract importance to us, because it really does help us better characterize fishing mortality, and through that, of course, produce more accurate stock assessments, and through that, more accurate and more consistent management advice. So any erosion of the resources that are necessary to meet those minimum bycatch estimation standards do have consequences, and they propagate through the system. And I think it's important to bear that in mind during this discussion. It's also true that increasingly we're using observers to support management information needs, and that's a growing demand that's being placed on the observer program. We've seen that in discussions already at this meeting, and I don't think a meeting goes by without the need for observers to monitor within new regulatory measures that the council is considering is under discussion, and the issue of how we deal with underwriting the costs from the agency's point of view and in the future, and this is another topic for discussion today, how we might be able to share those costs with the industry. But the idea here today is to give you as much of an overview as we can in the time allowed, to explain, again, how the economics of the observer program work and what the limits are to what it is we can deliver, so that when Wendy hands over to Doug and he starts talking to you about the SBRM amendment itself, you'll have the necessary context to understand what the consequences of this are likely to be. So, Wendy, if you could.
Okay, thanks, Bill. I'll be talking about three general topics, where we get the money, how much money we've typically gotten, and where we spend it. Just a quick review. We have three flavors of observers at the center. We have the standard Northeast Fisheries Observer, NEFOP Observer, And these folks generally monitor things like marine mammal bycatch, our standard bycatch reporting methodology, and then specific management programs, for example, a high-volume sampling in the Atlantic herring fishery. Our ATSI monitoring program is devoted to sector monitoring in the Northeast multi-species FMP. And then we have a component of industry-funded scallop observers that are funded and implemented through the Atlantic Sea Scallop FMP. The funding for these programs comes from seven different sources, and I'll walk through each one of those later on. One thing to note is the Northeast Observer Program was previously known as the New England Quarter-Order Groundfish, and we've had a change in the description that goes with that funding so that we're now able to use this for SBRM funding coastwide. So our Marine Mammal Observer Program funding goes to trips dedicated to monitor marine mammal bycatch, primarily of harbor porpoise and bottlenose dolphin. Our Atlantic Coast Observer coverage funding goes to cover standard bycatch reporting methodology, which is, as Doug will allude to, is a coastwide statistically based and designed program. Our Northeast Observer component also supports standardized bycatch reporting methodology. And between those two lines, we fund some management programs, for example, to monitor the butterfish cap in the Lolago fishery, and then herring closed area coverage. We also get a little bit of money under the reducing bycatch line, which we use for Atlantic herring monitoring. And then the national catch shares line is devoted to at-sea monitoring in support of catch shares. The National Observer Program line contains a variety of sublines to it. We have funding in there for at-sea monitoring. That's where we support the infrastructure associated with the industry-funded scallop program, special projects like electronic monitoring or technology developments, and then this past year a little bit to restore some previously rescinded Atlantic Coast funding in a previous line. We also have received funding from ASMFC to monitor inshore fisheries. This is what we use the funding for. And here are the typical historic funding levels from FY 11 to 14 in thousands of dollars. This is funding that's allocated to the fishery sampling branch. So some of this, some funding we get from other lines. We have, for example, a component in the catch share line that also supports some social science performance, economic and social performance monitoring. So this is money that we get from, again, that goes directly to the branch, and it includes some carryover. So in some years, if we some of that money is counted a little bit twice. So, for example, in FY14, we received this year some carryover funding from FY13 that actually came from a different funding from a different source. In this case, from headquarters. There, you'll notice that the funding varies from year to year. This is due to a variety of reasons. There are headquarters rescissions. There are various policy decisions in terms of how these lines are split at the national level. In some cases, for example, the National Observer Program has special projects that are added in some years. The National Catch Shares line has decreased over time. We had a large allocation in the beginning when we were starting up the program. We were targeting 100% coverage in or funding 100% of all of the observer costs or the ATSI monitor costs in the program in FY2012. In FY13, it was reduced because we were anticipating only covering 50% of the cost. We were able to manage to cover 100% by carrying over sea days from previous years. And then in the past year, that number has bumped up a little bit, again, because of this carryover. The to-be-determined component of the ASMFC money depends on individual state allocations. So you can see that the biggest lines, if you think of the name of AN, you've got A for Atlantic Coast Observers, which is generally around over a million. Northeast Observers, which is between 4 to 6, 7 million. And then a National Observer Program, which is around 3 to 4 million. So this total, again, has fluctuated between around $11 and $16 million a year. Got to get my buttons straight here. How do we fund ATSI monitoring? Our approach is to cover the SBRM requirements as fully as possible, and we do that by taking using the funding from the Atlantic Coast and Northeast Observer lines, and we also take out about 500 days worth of coverage for this closed area Atlantic herring coverage. Then the agency determines the total target minimum coverage rate annually. We look at what we're able to get out of SBRM, and then we figure out the difference. And that's how many sea days we need to cover under our at-sea monitoring program. So we basically augment that SBRM coverage with at-sea monitor coverage, and we use the National Observer Program and National Catch Share lines to top that off. If it turns out that we manage to meet those targets and we have any surplus, then we can use that to consider that to prioritize later. So that wraps up what goes in and then what goes out. We've got two basic components of the monitoring programs. One is within the center, and we refer to that as infrastructure costs. There are three components to this, and I'll go a little bit into them and how much we spend on them. One called operations, and I'll describe what that includes, training and data processing. And then we have a second component that we pay out that leaves the center that goes to observer service providers under contract agreements. So if we look at how much we spend on our operations, first of all, what are operations? These are the folks that go out and figure out the sampling protocols, the kind of gear that you're going to need to implement the protocols. For example, are you going to need an inclinometer on that stick to make sure the stick's going up and down exactly straight? Safety concerns. These folks train the trainers when we develop a new protocol, deal with the contractors, interact with vessels, the U.S. Coast Guard, law enforcement, generate standard data reports, oversee the pre-trip notification system, participate on PDTs, and review regulations. There's a mixture of permanent and contract labor in this under this category, and we also have some fixed costs like building leases and equipment maintenance. So we've got about $2 million of fixed costs. We have about a little under $80,000 of what I'm calling mixed costs, because some of those I can't split the supplies out between all of those three components. So this is for all of the three operations at once, and some of that scales depending on how many sea days we execute. Then there are things like variable costs that scale as a direct function of the number of sea days we execute, for things like observers shipping their reports back. The paper reports back quickly. So the total for all of this is around $2.2 million, and of that, about $2.1 is what we consider fixed cost. The training budget is a little smaller. We have permanent labor and contract labor that train observers, at-sea monitors, and industry-funded scallop observers. They train the high-volume catch folks. They develop the curriculum and improve classes. There are some components here that are more variable, a larger component here that is variable. These are things like vessel training trips and security clearances. So if we have fewer observer training sessions, then these costs are going to go down because those are on a per-session basis. And then every once in a while we have some costs that don't fall into either category. For example, we need new manuals or the classroom needs some kind of an upgrade. Our data costs include our data editors, who are probably the core of our data quality. They're all ex-observers. They all have multiple years of experience, and they work directly with the observers to improve things like incorrect coding, subsampling, to make sure that was slippage versus operational discards, for example. And we maintain a large fraction of that as contract labor. But in fact, these are people where if we shrink the number of sea days, we don't necessarily want to release those people back into the regular labor pool because it's impossible to get somebody back at the same level of quality that we currently retain. So we don't scale that contract labor as a function of sea days. Instead, we turn the data around more quickly. There are some intermittent costs here. For example, we acquired some tough pads for field technology for data entry because our previous entry method was We can't get those anymore. So the total cost for data processing is about $2 million, and then we have the grand total of all of our infrastructure costs are about $5.1 million. Now, out of that $5.1 million, $4.7 million of that are fixed costs. So we can scale this process very little by changing the number of C days. So when this has the effect, when we talk about what's the cost per C day, we take that fixed cost and amortize it or spread it out over all the days that we execute. So, for example, if we cover fewer days for some reason, let's say that there's less effort or there's less funding, then that fixed cost gets spread over fewer C days, and the infrastructure component of the C day cost goes up. And conversely, when the number of observed days goes up, the infrastructure cost per C day goes down. And in fact, the fixed cost is staying the same. And it just as when we were forced to describe it on a per day basis, it becomes artificially influenced by the number of days that we execute. In terms of the cost that we pay out, this is what we pay to service providers under current contract agreements. It's not necessarily the same cost structure that people would define on an industry-funded observer agreement. But under our contract, the primary source of outgo is to support observer at sea time. So this is the days at sea that observer is present. This is not the observer salary. This is the observer salary plus the contractor overhead. It includes their human resource expenses, all of their infrastructure, and their profit. We also have some directly reimbursable charges for travel. The observers are required to go to ports within 50 miles of their home base without travel reimbursement, but if there's coverage in further out ports, then we reimburse directly for travel. We also pay for the salary and travel for trainees and also land days when a vessel doesn't show up or when we have to bring an observer in for a debriefing. We also reimburse the vessel for more than if they're out for more than a day trip. And this leads to a variation in the C-day cost, in part because the pay scale of observers varies with the observer experience. So if you've got an experienced observer out in your vessel, we're going to get billed more for that observer than one that's just started out. The travel costs, again, are going to vary depending on how observers are distributed with respect to the coverage that's required. And then the amount of salary and travel of the trainees, that cost component depends on, for example, if the provider is new and is staffing up and we need to train more observers to staff them, how fast the observers are turning over. The number of land days is a function of how many no-shows, and the meal allowance depends on the trip lengths, and then the whole overhead in the operation is a function of the individual contractor business model. So it's very rare that we have a C-day cost that we pay an observer provider that's identical because each one of these variables is going to change for each trip. This is a very loose description of what we've spent on C-days and C-day accomplishments, and it's loose in terms of the correlation between C-day spending and the C-days accomplished. We put the money into the C-day contract by fiscal year, and then we draw it out. It's just like a checking account. We put it into the account in the fiscal year, and then we draw it out over the following year, or in some cases, years. So I've tried to adjust the C-day accomplishments to match the fiscal years by offsetting them a little bit. It's not a very perfect match, again, because the money comes in, but we don't necessarily, the checks go out the checks are written on a different schedule. So if we take those really aggregate numbers, we can see some fluctuations between, say, 5 to 746, depending on how well the C-day accomplishments match into the fiscal year funding. My assumptions there. The same thing we've done for at-sea monitoring, and again, you can see those costs per day fluctuate from year to year, in some cases by $100, $200. And again, that's a bit of an artifact, or part of it's noise in terms of the relationship of the timing of the actual C-Day execution. And there's also, over the past couple of years, we've had a variety of different contract vehicles. We've had an original contractor. We had a bridge contract, we had to implement because the next contract was not awarded timely. And so then we have a new contractor. So we have probably about three or four different kinds of contractors in here that are also making that that fluctuate from year to year. So that's the total C-Day accomplishments over all of the programs, and we've ranged from about high in this point of FY11 of around 16,000. In FY13, that dropped to around 11,000. Again, this is a function of a variety of reasons. In some cases, it's due to a reduction in effort. In some cases, it's a new provider coming up to speed. And so you can see, based on taking that $5 million of infrastructure costs, dividing them by those different numbers of C-Days supported, you get anything from $300 to $475 a day for the infrastructure costs, yet the costs themselves have been constant, pretty constant over time. So that's where we've been. And where do we think we're going to go? It's pretty clear that we have a finite capacity to expand. Even if somebody walked in with the biggest checkbook with an unlimited number of zeros, we can only expand so far given the space and communication and administrative structure of the branch. We have the capacity to support about 15,000 C-Days annually. That's what we have on the books this year to order for C-Days to be executed in the next fiscal year. We could expand a little bit, maybe another couple thousand days per year, but beyond that, it would be pretty difficult. And this is in part why. This is the floor plan for the Tech Park, where our observer program is lodged. Don't be fooled by those white spaces. They're filled with files or observer training rooms or where the trainees hang out when they're not being trained. You could see there's a little space. You could probably shoehorn in a couple more people, but you're not going to shoehorn in another 20 people. Part of the reason people say, well, you just get another building, it's not that simple. If we do that, there's going to be a break in service. We have to wire all this for IT, meaning government security requirements. So moving is not a trivial task. What do we do if we can't increase the number of people to address these problems? We do have some potential technological improvements in terms of increasing the efficiency and the quality of the data. Right now, we're working on an improved observer data entry system for the field. Our tough pads you'll probably start seeing on boats before the end of the year. These enable have automatic error checking functions built in, makes the linkage between the photos and the database much more transparent and seamless. And so that should reduce the amount of work that the data editors will have to do in terms of checking errors and trying to link up, you know, pictures of bycatch with the actual trawl log. We also have a new database system that allows for custom data collection programs. So, for example, if we have to now go out and take volumetric measurements on, say, 8 fish holds, we have to come up with, you know, a way to deal with those, put in 8 more fields in our database, and then were we able to observe it, and if not, why? Right now, we have to take the one-size-fits-all database and force that into that. In some cases, under this more flexible system, we could have something that was directly address those specific kinds of variables only collected in that fishery. The bigger picture, though, is probably a more integrated fishery monitoring system, and I think Melissa will make some allusions to this in her presentation on electronic reporting and EM, but this is one way to develop some much more efficient economies of scale so we don't have a whole bunch of disparate databases that everybody has to use different kinds of formats and coding in order to get the information out that we need. Finally, we can also improve some efficiency by smoothing some external interactions. If we can increase the collaboration to make deployments more efficient, if people can interact more positively with in terms of trying to get observers out, then we don't have to keep following up in some cases between providers and vessels in order to execute the program. We do have the potential for industry funding and cost sharing on the horizon. However, again, bear in mind, we have a finite amount of infrastructure capacity, so even if industry were willing to fund every bit of observer coverage, there is a possibility that, or 100% coverage in every fishery, we would not have the infrastructure capacity to do that. And finally, importantly, that allocation of funding may be limited in the future under that SBRM amendment. So you think of those budget lines and those big high-dollar amounts that were going into other programs now will all be functionally potentially rooted into SBRM. So in summary, although our funding is varying from year to year, it's probably we don't see any big increases on the horizon. We have a lot of infrastructure costs that are fixed, and so when you're talking about a C-day cost, that's going to fluctuate depending on how many days we actually execute on a per-day basis, but those costs are pretty much not going to be that flexible from year to year. Meanwhile, the at-sea component of that cost is going to vary from trip to trip depending on a number of, seven or eight different variables I discussed. We are close to capacity right now in terms of the number of days we can execute. If we're going to expand, then there are going to be significant breaks in services. We do see some hope for some technological innovation that will both improve the quality and quantity of the data as well as the timeliness. And again, the SBRM amendment is going to affect the way that we execute a lot of regional monitoring plans and especially those related to management objectives.
Thank you, Wendy, for a very informative presentation. I'm sure there's questions. Laura.
Thank you for the presentation. I just had a question as to whether you partner at all with the Canadians to see, how our monitoring programs compare to theirs, because the input I've gotten is that their sort of cost basis is much lower. And so I just didn't know if you do any sort of idea sharing with them.
Yeah, we do. We regularly interact with other fishery observer programs. And part of the differences in costs, I went through and gave you a breakdown of all of these different cost categories. This is 100% of the cost. And so when you see the costs that come out of some other programs, you have to be very careful to find out what actually is included in those costs. So you may get an estimate that doesn't include a component that we include in the cost.
Other questions? Mary Beth.
Thank you. I think, first of all, thank you for the presentation. We've had a lot of questions over time about the cost of the program, and this is extremely important as we look towards industry paying for observer days. I mean, in herring, groundfish, certainly it's on the horizon, and people have a lot of concerns about that. And I think that this is a good starting point. I think we're actually going to need to get into more detail that, you're not able to cover in this type of presentation. But, to get the cost down, we need to know more information about, observer at sea time versus travel, training and all these things. All the different components here are extremely important. And I think that people need to understand where cost savings could be achieved. Both for the program, but also on the industry side. I think that some of the activities of the industry are increasing costs, and people need to be aware of that. And we reference them, but in general, I don't think it's well understood on what the industry needs to do. Third-party providers, all the details. I think this is like a first step. And we need to take the next step to get more into the details of, how can we save money. The one thing I did know was, historical C-day spending, the slide. In 2011, the cost per day was like $746, and then 13 it went down to $542. And in your presentation, you said something about noise. However, for an industry to pick up that's significant. That's a percentage that's a lot. And when I first went through this material, I thought I had an impression, if we increase the number of days, the infrastructure cost remains constant, so the cost per day went down. But then today, looking at it, it seemed like our actual number of days went down and the cost per day seem to go down as well. So I think somewhere in there I had a disconnect. I don't know if you can...
Yeah, this component here is what we pay to the contractor, so that does not include the infrastructure costs. So this is the components that are the observer salary, the contractor overhead, travel training, et cetera. And these are things that we negotiate as part of our contract, and to the extent that you want to follow that model, we can give you advice on that. But that's, again, that's the function, that's within the function of our current contract structure. And so the contracts that you may enter into with observer service providers may have the expenses structured very differently.
So just a very quick follow-up. Again, thank you for this presentation. I think we need to get into the specifics more, perhaps in our next agenda item. But it's a very good starting point, so thanks.
David.
Yeah, Wendy, thank you. On I guess it's slide 13, you show the ATSI costs, and you note observer ATSI time, contractor overhead. Could you define what the contract overhead is? I assume that means primarily insurance paid for the ATSI observers. Is that true? And what else might be the
overhead? Yeah, that includes things like insurance, their administrative structure, their human resource people, any benefits that they pay the observers, what they're making for profit, and there are some specifications that there are some things that we require them to do as part of the government contracting procedure. You have to have a mechanism in place to for veteran recruitment and things like that. So there's a lot. It's all of the operating costs that the contractor incurs to get the observers out there. Things like, area coordinators, for example, to make sure that C-day schedules are being met on the contractor side. Receiving notifications from our pre-trip notification system, determining if they have a pool of observers available, who's going to go where, in terms of a taxi dispatcher. So those are the types of expenses that are in there, but that's that's the bid that the contractor puts forward that says I can deliver you, a 6-hour, let's say a 6-hour for every 6 hours of putting an observer out here. Here's my price on it, and it includes whatever overhead that they need to make happen as well as their profit, like I said.
Okay. Do contractors pay for anything? Does the federal government pay everything, cost of their facility? I'm trying to figure out to what extent are contractors actually providing any financial resources themselves, or are they just absolutely totally dependent upon the service to pay for everything?
The way the contract is set up now, they bill us under these categories. So that's the way that we've structured it. There may be another way that wouldn't necessarily, trying to think of what they would bring in terms of matching. I suppose it would end up being expertise, but we're buying a product.
So you're paying for the building that they may be in, that is their office building, everything.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Conceivably, or a portion of their building costs, whatever. Okay. Again, this is a competitive bid process, so there are other providers that are also generating budgets and C-day costs.
John.
Yeah, just a follow-up to that, and I may have missed it, but, the observer on the boat is certainly not getting paid what the boat is being charged. So what is the built-in profit margin for these third-party providers in these contracts?
I don't know, and I don't know if that's something that, as part of as part of the confidentiality of the contract agreement, I don't know if they even give us that breakdown. But it may be proprietary information. But I couldn't tell you.
Would it be possible to look into that? Because I think that's something we talk about: who's paying for what. I think That would be something I think at least this committee member would be very interested in, because the complaints I hear are it's whatever much per day, and the guy says he's getting paid a couple $100 a day. I appreciate the triple net lease type of arrangement that it sounds like we're paying, but I'd be very interested in the profit margins.
Tom.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I actually have two questions. My understanding, if we go to slide six, my understanding is that congressional funding for regional and national observer programs over basically the last 5 years has been steadily stable and increasing. If I look at slide six, it looks like the entire decline demonstrated over that time scale can be attributed to the national catch shares line item, which peaked in 2011. I think if you probably move that back a couple of years, that would, when did that start, 2010?
I think we may have gotten some funding in 2010, but I think most of it was in 2011.
Right. So, I mean, if you're actually talking about historic funding, I think if you step back past that sort of one-off peak, you're essentially stable and increasing. I mean, and that's the sum total of the decline. Is that right?
Well, I'd be wary of the increase in this past year, which, again, was we had some carryover funding released to us that was a one-time change in the way we did accounting. So that increase in FY14 is not going to be sustained in future years. That was a one-time change in the way the accounting worked. Going back earlier than FY11, if we take the national catch shares out of the mix, there's probably some fluctuation, again, in the National Observer Program line, depending on what special projects were included in any one year. And also, that line has also had some shifting of catch share, some shifting for at-sea monitoring funding in recent years. So going back further than that, I would say, yes, it would probably be about the same order of magnitude for each one of those lines, with, again, some year-to-year variation depending on congressional on rescissions or short-term shifts in headquarters allocations.
So that I understand, the congressional funding for observer program activities since basically 2008 has been increasing nationally.
Component to component, yeah.
So overall, there are, we have more money to address the activities associated with this program at the national and regional level since 2008.
I don't know. I haven't looked back in 2008.
My second question, if you could go to slide 18, I guess it's more of a comment. I guess I'm just a little bit frustrated with the comments that with unlimited funding and an identified management need by the council in terms of data that we need to serve our management purposes, that we can't find a way to get that done. I mean, I'm frustrated that the government that routinely puts people in space can't find a way. It's a little bit insulting, I think, to put up the floor plan or to suggest that changing over the wires is a reason why not to do something. If we identified that we needed to do it, we had unlimited funding.
If we had unlimited funding, yes. But as I mentioned in the last slide, that's not the reality that we have right now.
I'm sorry. During your presentation, you said with unlimited funding, we still couldn't do it because we don't know where to put it on new desk.
Conditions, okay. Under current conditions, we have a finite capacity to expand. Okay, so if we had people were interested in a break in service and were interested in putting that kind of resources into it, yes, it would be possible. The last time that we ended up going through an expansion like that that involved a space issue took us probably about 8 months to a year before we were fully operational. So as long as people understand that, yes, there's going to be lags in your data, you won't get the turnaround time while we make this transition, and we're going to have to play catch-up afterwards, yes, that's possible. I'm just trying to look at this from a realistic perspective because it's yeah, with unlimited funding, you can do anything. But the odds are, for the amount of funding we would need to be to infuse this, we don't see this on the horizon.
I guess with that, I just continue to identify that our job here is to identify what we need to have, and our job collectively is to provide the resources. And my understanding is, over the last 5+ years, those resources have at least been stable, and I think in net been steadily increasing. And we have to find a way to get that job done. And it feels a little bit like hostage taking, to be honest, or finding reasons why we can't do something that we've agreed, this council's agreed, that we need to do. So I hope never to see a floor plan for the observer program again, if possible. I just think we need to find a way to avoid these kinds of conversations.
Okay, well, like I said, this is what we have coming in to work with, and this is the best we can do with it. If there are large windfalls, that's fine. Operationally, yeah, there are going to be some challenges to make things continue over time. And we're not averse to it, but it just doesn't seem like a very immediately realistic scenario to go through and double the size of the program. And Bill may have some comments, too.
Well, Bill, if I may, I actually do think that it's perfectly appropriate to share with the council what the constraints are that we're working under. This is not intended to draw a line and say there is no way that we can go beyond this. It is intended simply to inform people of the circumstances that we are working under now and what the limits are. It's clear that with significant additional resources, we can extend our capacity. It's not a trivial exercise, but it's something that we certainly would be able to do, and I think Wendy explained that very clearly. So I'm really not sure what the problem is.
Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I've been listening. I guess this is a question that follows up on Dr. Karp's position. I think everyone at this table understands that expanding operations requires interruptions in services, increased capital. Obviously, you wouldn't consider expanding those operations without increased capital flow or expectation thereof. Many people here run businesses. I do not, but I understand that to expand an operation, it requires work. I think everyone at this table understands that. The question I have is the timing of you reminding of these operational realities. I find it curious. I share Tom's frustration. I find it curious that this is the time that you've chosen to point out a well-known truth that most of us accept and work with every day, that to expand operations takes time and effort and resources and interruption of services. So my takeaway is that the reason why we're being reminded of this truth is indeed to draw a line in the sand. And maybe that may not be your explicit intent, but the timing of it and the context within which this discussion is coming up, it's to warn us that says, if you want more observers, it's not going to happen because of operational constraints. So I share Tom's frustration with this, that this is a very well-supported demonstration of what most of us know. And I'm interpreting it as a warning that we're not going to do any more. We can't do any more. So I apologize if this comes across confrontationally. I certainly don't mean it. You and I have a good relationship, Dr. Karp, and I don't mean to put that into question. But I question the timing of this presentation today.
Bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, the timing of this presentation today is very deliberate with regards to the discussion that the council needs to have on SBRM, which does bring constraints, and I would ask you to wait for that presentation so that you fully understand how that plays out. It is not our intent in any way, shape, or form to draw a line in the sand. It is simply to be as clear and explicit as we can about the circumstances under which we work and what our options and alternatives are for addressing increasing needs. So any perception that this was intended to draw a line in the sand, I apologize for. I'm responsible for that, but that was certainly not our intent.
John?
There are a number of presentations that are all linked today, and We have some business, which is Doug's presentation following Wendy's on SBRM, where I hope this council will take final action as the MID did. And one of the things that the SBRM presentation will show is a decreasing amount of flexibility that we have. I think that we heard in the presentation of the Tiger Team a reality check informing us about how long it takes and a plea for realistic expectations. What we've heard in Wendy's presentation is a reality check about the cost of observers. I understand frustration. We'd all like to do things faster. We'd all like to have more. We want more. We want faster. What we're trying to introduce is some information, all right? And Bill says he doesn't want to draw lines in the sand, but these are lines in the sand, right? These are physical constraints. These are financial constraints. These are human resource constraints. These aren't lines in the sand. These are lines with dollar signs on them. These are lines with bricks and mortar on them. These are lines of number of people. And, you know, you can't ask Bill to print money. That he doesn't have that ability. This is about keeping our demands to what is possible. And it's us trying to give information so that we as a council, Bill and I are here as we, keep our request to what is within the realm of the possible. We all want more. It is trying to understand what we can do within what is possible. And when we want to do what's not possible, yes, it is going to generate frustration. But frustration isn't helpful. No, it doesn't solve problems. We're not in the space business, you know. We don't send people to space. You know, this is a lot more down to earth than that.
Okay, with Alan's and Mary Beth's hands raised for questions. You have a question too, Laura? Then we're going to conclude this and move to Doug's presentation before lunch. So, Ellen, Mary Beth, and Laura.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wendy, thank you very much. We requested of the service this information, and I appreciate you bringing it to us. I did have a question on page 6. What would be helpful to me is to see how much you actually spent in each one of these categories. As far as it looks here, this is what the funding was, but it doesn't say that was what you spent. And you say you have carryover. I'm assuming that some years you spent less and you used it the next year. Is that true?
Yes, this is what came in, and to make things simpler rather than subtracting it out on one side and then adding it in on another side. This was the simplest way to do it. The carryover component is primarily in 2014, and again, that was based on a change in bookkeeping or accounting. So that's a one-time deal. There are some small, I think maybe a small fraction in 2013. It's usually an anomaly to have funding carried over from year to year.
Okay, so what I'm saying is I think, and what Mary Beth said, is that this is a great starting point. It's not enough information for our needs. It gives us an idea of where we're going. And so one of the things that we would be really helpful to see is actually how much you spent in each category each year. And I don't expect you to have that here now. It's just
when you talk about each category in each year, what do you mean by categories?
The MMPA observers.
Okay.
You could take the same chart and then add to it. And I don't expect you to give it to us.
I'll tell you, the base, the raw data that went into this for each fiscal year comes out of about 100 pages. And the accounting system is, we can map out what we spent under each one of those lines in excruciating detail, as fine as you'd like to get. So it just depends on the level of aggregation. We tried to bundle it up here in terms of big categories. If you want to go through stuff line by line, we're happy to do that. Some of them, again, are just are small things like, you know, a box of file folders for a few dollars to, you know, $3 million into a labor contract.
I think basically what we need to know is in MMPA observers in 2011, you were funded $859,000. About how much did you spend of that for the MMPA observers?
Oh, it goes into an MMPA observer schedule. So within our observer CDAY schedules, we have schedules for each one of these types of monies. So the MMPA component of that money goes to fund what we call limited trips in fisheries that are of interest to take reduction teams. So that only goes to that component. It's not like we use MMPA money to do something else. And it's not that we can do it, because that was the intent of Congress.
I guess you're missing my point. It's not. I can talk to you about it later. I had a couple other comments. One is that once we get into the nuts and bolts of industry funded, the industry is not set up to all of the industry is not set up to negotiate contracts like this, and that was very evident when we tried to do the dockside monitoring. So I think that it would be really helpful if the service considered helping deal with that, having the contracts more clearly available, whatever is not, a private nature. We need some outreach.
That I think we have those statements of work and at least a form of those contracts on our website. There may be some parts that are redacted or not included because it's proprietary information, but the website does have some detailed contract information on it, as I recall.
Let's see. I had a couple other. You mentioned how your cost in stayed the same, and you also talked about retraining. You know, if the observers, there was a high turnover, you had to retrain them. I guess my question, what surprised me is that the observer companies that you hire don't pay for the training, that the service pays for the training. I can understand where you'd say, okay, we'll train 50 observers, and then they lose those. Does the service pay whenever they need to replace them?
We reimburse the contractor for the salary of the trainees and their training and their travel during that period. And that's, that would be negotiable. Conceivably, if they wanted to absorb that cost under some other category, they wouldn't break it out, and you could end up having that just lumped in the overall CDAY cost. That's the way we structured it, because because it's very clear, so that we can track that component of it.
One last question.
Okay, well, it's going to have to be, because we're about an hour and a half behind. In my question to Mike and Laura, Mary Beth and Gibb, are these burning questions that you need to have answered right now, or something that you can ask Wendy offline? It's a burning question, Gibb. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gibb Brogan with Oceana. Just one question. I watched this presentation when it went to the Mid-Atlantic, and have had a question for a couple of weeks. The concept of the 17,000-day cap, Is this a new analysis that's been done internally to come up with this operational cap? The reason I ask is that the SBRM, since it's been in place, has come up with the overall number of days that will meet the target across all of the fisheries of the region. And for every year that that analysis has been done, it has far exceeded that 17,000-day cap. And if we've known about this for, 2008, 2009, that the agency would never be able to meet the target level of coverage. This is something that should have been recognized and planned for the past 5 or 6 years. Is this a new internal analysis, or have you known about this for a while?
From my perspective, this is the first time we've gone through systematically and historically.
Okay.
Before we've, and I've used the analogy of soft-sided luggage, we've always been able to push something else in there, and now it's at the point where the zipper might break, so we're looking for an alternative suitcase, so to speak. I will say that we may be able to compensate in some cases, again, if we have a more efficient system that makes the data move faster and more effectively with the same number of people and increase the volume that way. So we have some optimism there that we may be able to compensate some ways, but that's a developing process.
Okay. The reason I ask this is in the context of the industry-funded observer amendment that's in the works right now, which, as I understand it, is going to go into place when SBRM targets have been satisfied, so it will be above and beyond SBRM. So that suitcase is going to have to get an awful lot bigger. And so as this council and the agency are coming up with the industry-funded amendment, I think it might be wise for the agency to start doing that strategic planning, and whether this council wants to make that advice and tell the agency what it might want to be thinking about. But it would be a shame to do the industry-funded observer amendment and not have the infrastructure waiting. The industry-funded amendment is going to take some time. The agency should do what it can to solve the problem and have the tools to do the job when that spits out the other end. So just using my crystal ball. Thanks. I appreciate it.
So Laura, Mike, and Mary Beth, you okay or with deferring your questions to offline? Or okay. Doug, you want to get set up? Laura.
I just wanted to offer a comment, is that just in response to Dr. Karp and Mr. Bullard's responses to the presentation, which, again, was super helpful. But I think sitting here, we have a lot of people who work for the government and are used to sort of the government way of doing things that is perhaps more cumbersome and slower. And there are those of us that are sitting here in industry, and just in the same way that I'm going to listen to what a fisherman, an ENGO, a government person says at the microphone, there are those of us that are sitting here in industry that say, oh, my goodness, 8 months to move an office? Are you kidding me? I mean, we, in 1952, shut down Foley Fish in Union Square, and the very next day opened Foley Fish in Dorchester. That's a manufacturing plant, you know, knives and water and hoses and not just computers, so in filing cabinets. So I want to be respectful, but I also want to say some of these constraints don't pass the sniff test, and some of these budget line items are things that we would never consider in a contract when we're contracting out labor or services. So I definitely encourage you to involve people who run businesses when you are looking at how to expand hours instead of just saying we can't. I'm hearing so much we can't today. I got to tell you, there are people out here in industry that have to work under budgets and dollar signs who actually can. So that would be my comment. Thank you.
Mike's hands up.
I think we're sort of wasting time and getting off track worrying about how big the office is and so forth. I think the bottom line is I having observed this sort of process and having lived in some of it, just don't think it's realistic to expect there's going to be a lot more federal money for a federally funded program. And if you think it is realistic, I'd invite you to go deal with the Office of Management and Budget and stuff like that, like Bill has to do. So ultimately, what I think we're talking about is we have to recognize that if there are expectations for a much larger program to serve a variety of additional needs from those for which an observer program was originally designed, we probably are going to have to figure out how to implement dual models. One model that works for the government appropriated funds for something like, you know, a standardized observer program, and another model that's more suitable for an industry funded program that serves somewhat different needs. And, you know, I think ultimately that's the direction that this is going to have to evolve to, because I just don't see there being a huge amount of additional government funding that's stable. You may get an add-on for a year and it'll, you know, be there for a while and then disappear. But realistically, I'd also comment, you know, having been involved in these sort of things around the world, I don't know of any other place in the world that spends more money out of the government coffers on observers than is being spent in the U.S. right now. And this is another realism as to the limit to the size that these programs are going to grow. Thank you.
Mary Beth, they've all commented.
Just very quickly, I think in some ways I agree with both of the previous commenters here, and I think that we do need to create that bridge of trying to insert some business thinking into a program that businesses are going to need to pay for. And that's my goal here is, you know, we need observer coverage. It needs to be affordable, you know, the cost of a day at sea. And so, therefore, this is a great starting point to us to understand what the costs are here, and we have a lot more work to do.
Okay. Doug, you're up, and following Doug's presentation, we're going to Doug's presentation.